So Richard Dolan is one of the world's leading researchers and writers on the subject of UFOs, and he believes that they constitute the greatest mystery of our time. Richard Dolan, welcome to the show, and tell us, why are UFOs the greatest mystery of our time, and why should we even bother people with this subject today?
Hi, David.
Oh, we got an echo there.
Having a little bit of feedback here.
Oh, here, let's do this. Do you have the stream open as well, maybe? It could be because you have the YouTube stream.
I heard you about 5 seconds apart each time. So let's.
Oh, okay.
I'm plugging these headphones back in and hoping I'm not.
Oh, you know what? I'll tell you why. You probably have the YouTube feed open at the same time. Do you have the link open?
I cannot understand.
It's all echoey on his end. I think it's because he's got the feed open on his end. Sorry, guys. Welcome to the show. We're going to fix this feedback up. I think it's because Richard has the link open at the same time as the show. You have the links open. Yeah, I think you have the live link open. You're one of the viewers. You're one of the viewers and one of the guests.
I'm sorry. How are we doing now?
Now we're good. No, you can hear. We're good.
This was my fault. I had way too many tabs open.
It wasn't that, Richard. It was black helicopters flying over your house, pinging your server and messing up with your voice because they don't want people to know what you know.
Welcome. I know people could hear what I was hearing. I did hear your question, David. Thank you, by the way, for having me on. And it's such a pleasure to be doing this with you. So I will tell you why I think UFOs constitute the greatest mystery of our time. It's a phenomenon that is not supposed to exist by every stretch of logic that we have in our society. That is, everything that we're told from the moment we're born into this culture of ours, that, you know, maybe there's life out there, but they're not here. Maybe one day we'll discover life out there, but we haven't done so yet. All of the official body of knowledge that's come down to our culture has said to people, UFOs are not anything that's extraterrestrial. They're ultimately all explainable and so forth. And yet that's not true. So that is not true. And why would I have the audacity to say that's not true in defiance of what scientific establishment have to say about it? And the reason is simply that I bothered to look at the evidence in a great amount of detail, which I can guarantee you every one of those scientists who makes these pronouncements that it's not real hasn't done. There are thousands upon thousands of outstanding sighting reports for anyone to look at if they bother to take the time, and in particular military sighting reports, which in my view are the most interesting, not because they're the best intrinsically, but because military agencies, military entities have equipment, they've got money, they've got the ability to track these objects normally in ways that are much better than ordinary citizen can, and they leave, when we're lucky, a paper trail as to how they handled these encounters. And what we know through the United States history, as well as through the history of many other nations, including Canada, including European nations and Russians and everyone else, basically, is that their militaries have encountered these objects and have generated a great amount of concern, a great amount of concern. So it's a real phenomenon. And, you know, who's behind it, what is behind it is another question. And that's part of the mystery. Is it extraterrestrials? Well, I think it probably is, but I do strongly feel it's something that's unexplained in our current paradigm. And the reason it's the greatest mystery of our time is because unlocking the secret of whatever it is UFOs are officially and finally for all of our society to talk about will constitute the greatest transformation, I believe, of human civilization that we've probably ever experienced, or at least as big as since the introduction of farming 10,000 years ago. So it'll be a big thing. It's a major existential transformation in our society once we are able fully to acknowledge openly that there's someone else that's here. It's not us. And the rest of our time is going to be expended trying to understand exactly who and what they are. And there'll be a lot to learn for sure.
Wow, great answer, man. I knew that you'd be the one that could answer that. And I want to get into some of the details of that and your work. But first of all, I just want to say, man, you look great. It's been a while since we've seen each other and got back in contact. So I hope you're well. I heard that you came to Canada and abducted one of our women. And just like the ancient aliens that came from all over the universe for the women of this planet, you came to Canada and you took one of ours and you brought her back to your planet. Congratulations on the new marriage, Richard. I hope all is going well.
Thanks very much, Dave. Yes, I recently married Tracy Garbutt, who is Canadian. She is originally from Ontario, Mississauga, near Toronto, but lived most of her adult life in British Columbia, mostly Vancouver and Whistler. When I met her, she was actually living in Florida. Nice warm weather down there. So you could say technically I abducted her from Florida, but she's a Canadian all the way through, with the red sweaters and the hot chocolate and the hockey sticks in the corner of the room.
And maple syrup. She loves pancakes.
The maple syrup, the whole thing. It's all there. So we have a, we have a great time, actually. And I love I'm considering myself already an honorary Canadian.
You are.
There we go. I love it.
I'll make it official because you actually came and did a 12-stop tour from one end of Canada to the other. We had to sleep together in a, well, not together, but separate beds in a, in an RV.
Pretty close.
We were pretty close at times and we had a great time with that. And Richard, at that time you had written this book. It was a fantastic book called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. I got to see your presentation on that 12 times. And I took notes every single time, and I've read the book and referenced it many, many times, and I've recommended it to a lot of my friends because I felt that you did a really good job of bringing serious academic level research to the work, but also broke it down in a way that the average person that maybe doesn't have the time to go through all the details of this subject would be able to actually absorb. And so congrats on that book. And I know you've had a new book coming out, or that's come out, on false flags. And I mean, what else have you been working on? Do you have anything else in the pipeline you want to let people know about?
Well, thank you for commenting on 21st Century Mind, first of all. I really wanted that book to be a great overview of the entire UFO subject for someone who just wanted to know what's the big deal. Why are UFOs important? Why do they matter? And so what I tried to do with that book was, yes, using good research, but writing in a comprehensible way to describe, you know, why are UFOs philosophically so interesting? Why are they historically important? You know, what is the history of UFOs from ancient aliens to today, as far as we can understand? Mm-hmm. What's the whole deal with abduction or contact that people have? And what is the science of this impossible phenomenon? There actually is many, many aspects of science that connect with it. What's the nature of the cover-up? Is there a political aspect of it? The answer is yes, there absolutely is. What does the future look like, and much more? How has our own perception of the UFO phenomenon evolved over the years? So all of that is in UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and I did intend it to be the ultimate one stop for someone who really wanted to know why it mattered. Other projects I've done since then, I have been working quite a bit on the phenomenon known as false flags. We can talk quite a bit about that. My false flag book is not out. I did write a fairly long series on false flags for Gaia TV, which people can go take a look at. And that deals with, it's an analytical history, I would say, of false flags as a phenomenon. And for someone who doesn't know exactly what I mean by that, a false flag is something done by a group, or could be a person, but often a group, like a government or an intelligence agency, something horrible, something traumatic, often something violent, something fearful, that is then blamed on another party, blamed on someone else, normally with a view toward justifying actions that could not otherwise be justified, like passing laws or invading countries and the like. That's a false flag, and there's a history of them. And I have been working to document the full history of false flags throughout human civilization, actually. What I've found is that there are some probable ancient false flags. But as a real phenomenon, false flags didn't truly take off, in my view, till really the 20th century. And they are now absolutely part of our world. And it's like a virus that keeps mutating. As our society continues to advance, so too do these false flags become ever more sophisticated, in my view.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting subject. I'm glad you've done some historical look at that, because what we're really analyzing here is how it seems to be a pattern within human society that obviously there's going to be strategy that's used to obtain power on behalf of various groups or individuals, as you say. And if for those that might be thinking, oh, this is all conspiracy stuff and I don't want to get into that, you got to understand that, I mean, think of any game or think of the world of business or anything that you're going to do. If you want to gain an unfair advantage and you want to have a power differential of some kind, in today's day and age, there are honorable ways of achieving that, but there are also many people that will take the dishonorable route, and they will use deception, they will use violence, they will use coercion, they will use illegal methods to subvert the authority that's in place and to take over the reins of power. It's sort of like the old Trojan horse kind of concept. And so I feel like in many ways, this is happening across the political and social landscape. We're seeing the discussion that's happening right now, you know, with the Trump era and with what's going on in Europe and across many Western countries, as well as what's going on in the Middle East. It's all coming to a boiling point. And the question I would have is, so many people are focusing in on the details of that, and we need people to go in and analyze those individual events. But you're a big picture guy, Richard. I mean, you're also looking at this from a cosmic perspective, that this planet is not just isolated and alone and left to its own devices. We're also, it seems to be that there's something engaging with this planet, and it's probably been engaging with this planet since we've been here or even before. Mm-hmm. How does, for you, if you're writing a book 1 minute on UFOs for the 21st century mind and then going into the world of false flags, and I know you cover a lot of things about politics, how do you mingle those, and how does that all blend together to form some kind of cohesive theory of what's going on?
I'm still finding a way to answer that question, Dave, but I do think that they are related in the sense that you have one very big thing here, UFO phenomenon. There's another very big thing over here, which is the false flag phenomenon. I think that there definitely have to be connectors. I guess what I would say is that, you know, the UFO subject didn't just drop into everyone's lap. It did, but it also dropped into the lap of the national security apparatus, particularly that of the United States after World War II, the most powerful national security apparatus in the world by far. And so that they handled that phenomenon in a certain way, and primarily a way of dealing with it by means of secrecy and cover-up. It's not that they weren't justified. You know, we could see it from their point of view. They've got a phenomenon that they don't know how to deal with. They don't know what these other beings are, most likely. They don't know how to talk about this to the public.
Right.
It's not difficult to see why they would at least provisionally decide to hold off on discussing this with the public and just getting all the information that they can. The problem is that secrecy develops a life of its own and its own profitability too, particularly if you've uncovered technology that is very advanced and it might unlock secrets to power and to money and to domination. So the UFO phenomenon vaulted much of the world, especially the United States, into a world of deep, profound secrecy. So now that's not the same as the world of false flags. But what happened is that this very same United States found itself striding across the entire world, dominating many of the nations on this planet and wanting to dominate all the rest. And false flags became very important for that United States as a way of controlling nations, subverting elections, rigging all kinds of elections, which they did and still do. It's a funny thing, you know, in the US we hear everyone talking about how Russia interfered with the American elections. And I'm like, are you crazy? That's our job. That's what America does.
We already do it.
America rigs elections, and no one does it better. No one even comes close to achieving what the United States has achieved internationally in terms of rigging elections. It's not even a contest. But anyway, and by the way, the US rigged the Russian election of 1996 for Boris Yeltsin and was proud of it. And that's out in the open. My point is that with false flags, this became something that the United States mastered as part of its global empire strategy, is how I would put it. Now, there's domestic false flags, but just looking at it internationally, the United States really has used false flags internationally to control its allies and subvert its adversaries to the extent possible. How does that relate to the UFO phenomenon? I'm not sure. I got into false flags as an extension of my longstanding interest in geopolitics. Long before I was interested in UFOs, I was a student of international politics and geopolitics. And then diving into the UFO phenomenon, I became very aware of just how deep secrecy could be. Mm. You know, it's not simply that politicians are corrupt, which sure, everyone kind of knows that, I guess, but it's so far beyond. And I only began to appreciate that once I started looking into the nature of the UFO cover-up. That is, you know, how did they keep the media silent? How have they kept the political institutions silent? How have they kept the academic community out of this? What levels of control exist from the intelligence community, from the national security community, to maintain control over this, as well as internationally? And once I started looking at all of the levers of power that were exercised primarily out of Washington, it became clear to me that this is a deep, deep, deep political secret, and it's a major undiscussed element of international political powers, how the U.S. is dominating its allies through the UFO cover-up and other types of cover-ups too. And so I think that's what got me into false flags. False flags is just one aspect of this whole element of control. And the other thing I guess I'll just say about false flags and why I got into it, I'm from New York City. My father was not only a retired New York City police officer for many years, but worked at the World Trade Center in New York City for 7 years, right up until September 2001. He happened to have Tuesdays off when September 11th happened, so he wasn't at work that day. He lived. A very nice man that he shared his job with was killed that day. So,
that's sad.
And I think it was it was horrible. I think, so with 9/11, I think what we can see now, many of us, is that 9/11 triggered, I think, a really fresh understanding by many people to look critically at the government, at the deep state, what we now call the deep state, and to look at false flags. I think 9/11, in other words, radicalized a lot of the world's population, you know, and it helped to clarify a lot of ideas in my own mind. So if there's a direct relationship between false flags and UFOs, not sure where I would go with that. There are people who believe that there's a UFO false flag coming, and that's a whole other.
The fake alien invasion and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That's a tough nut to crack, but I think you're the man for the job. What are you speaking about at the conference that's coming up really soon? We've got a conference called Architects of the New Paradigm. It's put on by some fantastic people. They're going to be in Vancouver. The date is June 30th. They've got Stephen Bassett, Grant Cameron, Tom Danheiser, Richard Dolan. I know that guy. Johnny Enoch, George Norrie, Daniel Sheehan, and Victor Vigiani. They're all speaking there. I'm going to be there as press this time. I'm going to be covering the event and interviewing you guys. And I promised to buy you a drink, Richard, so I'm going to hold true on that. But what are you doing in Vancouver on June 30th?
I'm actually still preparing that lecture, so it'll be exciting to me to find out what I'll be talking about. But I can pretty much say, it's just the truth. I've been developing a lot of fresh presentations over this last few months. And so I didn't want to have this one ready until close to the date. Actually, I can say it was by design, but I know what things I'm thinking about right now. And I, you know, to keep in theme with the conference itself, it's about living in a post-disclosure world as humanity awakens to the ET presence. That's really how it's designed. And so I've given that a lot of thought. I did write a book on this theme more or less 8 years ago called AD After Disclosure, which would be what is life? What would life be like if the UFO secret were ever to end? And excuse me, my co-author and I, after going through over 300 pages of that, I think we concluded that this would be the most radical of all developments in our history, at least in our modern history, because it's not simply recognizing that there are other beings that are here, other beings who seemingly are very advanced, who seem, at least judging by reports that people have given, very intensely telepathic, extremely intelligent, very powerful, have an ability to manipulate space-time reality, or so it seems to me. So they're operating on a wholly, completely different level, right? So that's one, as I call it, an existential challenge. to our species, just knowing that these other beings are here. It's almost as if we're going back to the days of the ancients who believed in gods living among us or living above us. You know, that was one thing about the ancient people, which is that they recognized, in my view, they recognized that we were not at the apex of creation, that we human beings were not, that there were others that were beyond us. With the age of science, starting in the 16th, 17th centuries, people started to think differently. They thought, oh, no, we're, forget angels and gods and so forth. It seems to be all about human beings, and we're at the top, and it's our ability to reason that makes us the top of the hierarchy. And so I think it's been this, given understanding among scientists and most educated people, actually, that there aren't the old gods. They don't exist anymore. There are no others that are beyond us. But what's interesting to me is that the UFO phenomenon, if you really take it seriously, seems to take us back to this other realization that maybe, after all, we're not at the top of the food chain, that there are others who have greater capabilities than we are. That's one element psychologically, but there's so much more that disclosure would, a true disclosure of this reality would bring to us. For example, political blowback is probably the most interesting element of this that I can think of, at least in the near term, is how would it rock the boat politically for any president of the United States? And I keep thinking of the U.S.-centered version. It doesn't have to be the U.S., but let's say an American president. You know, a few years ago, we would wonder if Barack Obama would disclose. Now it's, what if Donald Trump were to disclose the reality of this? How would it transform our world? And my feeling is that politically, there would be a lot of hell to pay. There are many people who would want to know exactly how did this cover-up work for so long? What institutions were subverted in making this cover-up function? Right. So how was the mainstream media, the corporate establishment, dinosaur media, that who even listens to these guys anymore, really?
Right.
But they still have power. And how is it that they were controlled? Well, we actually have some answers to that. You know, there's something known as Operation Mockingbird in the U.S. that existed for years. It still exists under different names. And that's a complete media control operation. But people will want to know the details. They'll want to know. They'll want to know where really has the academic community been? And they'll start looking into subversion of the academic community. And there's a great deal of that by the military intelligence communities to control types of discourse coming out of that field. And on and on. And then, you know, ultimately people will want to know, how deep does this cover up go within the government? Like, do you have acquired alien technology? Answer, yes, undoubtedly. Do you have bodies? And what's the status of your classified science? So all of that's going to come up. And, you know, I received an email a number of years ago from a reader who just said, you know, some of your ideas on disclosure, he said, I don't see happening because, you know, those of us in the classified world who've got access to this secret, and he implied that he was one of them, he said, we're never going to cooperate in giving this up until we are absolutely sure that we're not going to go to prison for what we've done. And he says, you know, promises of immunity really aren't going to cut it.
Yeah.
We really are going to need some serious assurances.
And makes until sense. We get, yeah.
There's not going to be any. So there's a lot of fear operating, I think, within that world. And for that reason, I don't really see a voluntary disclosure happening, but if it were ever to come out, it would be a massive upheaval. And then, of course, there's the science. How would that transform our world? Knowing that this is real, that by itself would liberate a lot of our scientific research into areas that are now considered, you know, totally fringe, whether it's free energy or zero point energy or anti-gravity propulsion systems, you know, field propulsion and things like that. So suddenly all of that will get opened up. And I think it would be a very, very short breathing space before our world is very radically transformed by an exploration of, for lack of a better word, ET science.
Yeah,
that's just the beginning.
Yeah, and I have a bunch of questions on that, but I want to just give a quick plug here for people to be able to come and see you live talking about whatever it's going to be you're talking about. It's always good. You definitely don't want to miss Richard's presentation. You can go to the website vancouver2018.anpconference.com, or you can just Google Architects for the New American New Paradigm Project.com, and you can check that out. And those tickets are going fast, so come and see me and Richard over there in Vancouver. Now, Richard, you were just mentioning about how there was a fear of releasing this information coming from the classified world, the government world. We haven't seen any of, well, we've had countries, other countries talk about this openly, but we don't have the official recognition from the U.S. government, and I think that's what everybody's waiting for. Do you think that maybe this will come out of the private sector instead, or maybe even the Vatican or something like that? You know, you were a part of the premiere episode of Ancient Aliens, the new season. I also had the opportunity to be a part of that episode. And they were talking about Bigelow Airspace and the whole Pentagon, UFO, whatever. I kind of think some of that might have been smoke and mirrors, but I feel there's better cases to be made than even that. But there's these guys coming from industry, coming from aerospace industry, coming from all kinds of different sort of corporate backgrounds that are talking openly about us and are investing money and investigation into this subject. Do you think that possibly it might come more from the private sector, like an Elon Musk or somebody like that, as opposed to Trump?
It's interesting. It could be, yeah, it absolutely is a possibility. The one thing, the caveat that I would have with that is someone like Elon Musk or Robert Bigelow, for example, these are people who have relationships with the U.S. Defense Department. Musk, I think just 2 months ago, was approved as an official, I forget the exact terminology here, but he was officially approved to do rocket launches for the Defense Department for space-based activities. And so what that tells me, I think U.S. Senator John McCain said it was wonderful. It opens up more competition among our vendors, which, sure, yes, that's true. But what's also true is that it brings Musk formally into the classified fold. Like, you're not going to get to do major classified work for the Department of Defense without adhering to their secrecy and security protocols. You just have to go along with that, or you're not part of the team. So presumably if a SpaceX mission or something of Robert Bigelow's goes out there, and let's say they encounter UFOs, well, that doesn't necessarily mean they're just going to say, hey, we're private citizens, let's tell everyone about it. That I don't think that will happen any more than if Boeing or Lockheed or Raytheon or any other major defense contractor had their own encounter with aircraft out there. So I think, you know, Musk would be brought very much into the fold. But the larger picture of what you're referring to, I think, is still a valid point. Like, we have to ask how long can the United States national security complex hold this the way they do? And let's make no mistake about it. All right, there's roughly about 200 or so sovereign nations on this planet, but they're not all equal. And the United States by far dominates most of them, really dominates most of them. Certainly its NATO allies, it dominates in terms of national security pretty much completely. There's really only a handful of nations on the planet that are outside the U.S. sphere, Russia, China being the most prominent, Iran, North Korea, Syria. You know, that's about it in terms of any significant nations. Most are at least nominally subservient and sometimes explicitly subservient to the U.S. And so that being said, the U.S. really controls a huge portion of what's going on here. And the question is, can they do that indefinitely? And there's a lot of other moving parts, like you mentioned, private individuals. And there's always new technologies coming on. I mean, there's, you know, next generation night vision binoculars that people will have access to. And
actually, you shared a story. Sorry to interrupt you there, Richard, yeah. But you just about speaking about night vision goggles, you shared an experience with me over a campfire one time about how you put some night vision goggles on. I don't know which, did you go up to see, what's that ranch outside of Washington there or wherever it was? And you were like, oh my God, there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on.
That's exactly right. This is actually in the U.S. State of Illinois. It was in near the town of Galena, Illinois, and people don't look it up. I was there back in, I think it was 2008, so about 10 years ago. And it was my first, not my last, experience with very sophisticated night vision binoculars. And there's a few of us out. We had about 2 hours from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. I think about 10 or 12 of us. And we had a couple of pairs of binoculars, so we were able to share. So we all got a pretty good view. And I was quite astonished at the amount of activity that I could see with those, as opposed to you take them off and you could almost see nothing. And it was a very nice clear night. And even so, most of the activity that we could see with the night vision glasses was not visible or barely visible without them. And I was kind of amazed. I think I counted about 100 different unusual objects that I saw with those on in 2 hours time in this one little corner of the earth.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of them were unusual. Some of them were very high altitude, fast objects, faster than any satellite I've ever seen. I don't know what these things were. There's rumors of things like trans-atmospheric vehicles, and maybe that's what we saw. But to be sure, there was a lot. And since that time, I've seen a number of other, I've had other night vision experiences that were interesting, not as interesting as that, but close. So there's a lot going on in the atmosphere. I'm totally convinced of that. Who's building it? I think part of it is our own human infrastructure. I think probably most of it is, to be honest with you. I think that there's like a little circumscribed fence that we all live within. And beyond that fence is a very significant infrastructure, in my view.
Yeah, I think I've heard a lot of incredible stories as well from people that you know, there's a lot of stories I've heard, people that don't want to go on record. I'm sure you've had the same experience, but have very compelling stories, who react emotionally to these stories, that they're not trying to do something to just go out and get famous, or they're trained observers. They know what they're looking at. And it's very, very compelling. And I think that when you're talking about the evidence for people out there that might be skeptical about this, what would you say is one of the more convincing pieces of evidence? I know you did a really good article a while back on, I think it was 12 government documents that talk about UFOs, very compelling. Yeah. But then you came into the Canadian National Archives and you found some incredible stories in there, again, from trained observers, documented. But what would you say, obviously it's a compilation of evidence, but what really stands out to you as a smoking gun that you would talk to in front of a skeptic of this subject?
What I would say is that in the officially released cache of documents from the United States government, I'll just start with them first, through Freedom of Information, that there is not a single document that proves UFOs are extraterrestrial. There isn't that, so just we'll forget that. There are several documents that are pretty indicative of that possibility, for sure, suggestive. But what I would say is that the top 10, top 20, top 50, top 100, actually, of these documents do prove something. They prove that the United States military has been deeply interested, deeply concerned with UFOs in a very serious way, and has lied all this time to the public about that interest. So that's proof. Like if I had to argue this on CNN, I could say that without hesitation. So that there's a fairly large stack of documents, some total of which prove it. And so what do these documents say? They'll describe violations of sensitive airspace time and again. One document I'm remembering off the top of my head from 1950, July of 1950, from the United States Army, which describes, in its word, objects round in form have been seen over the Hanford Atomic Energy Commission plant. That's Hanford, state of Washington. One of the most toxic sites in the United States, incidentally, a nuclear reactor. Objects round in form have been seen over the Hanford site. 30 objects, I think it's what it said. Air Force interceptors, no success. Anti-aircraft battalions have been alerted. Investigation is ongoing and so forth. That's very interesting. Can you imagine if that document alone were to have gone out to the general public? But then there's so many others just like this. A 1949 document from the FBI stating explicitly that this matter of flying saucers, as it was called back then, was considered top secret by the U.S. Army and by the Air Force. Very, very straightforward. A 1947 document, one of the most important, I think, of all of them, by U.S. three-star general Nathan Twining. Twining later became a four-star general and chief of staff of the Air Force. But in 1947, he was still a big wheel. And he was responding to an inquiry from another U.S. general about these flying saucers, which were in the news at that time. And Twining said, these reports convince us that this is something real, that this is not imagination. This is something real, not visionary or fictitious. And then he went on in this letter to describe, according to military observers, characteristics of these UFOs. A, they were extreme maneuverability and rates of climb and speeds. So that was something beyond what we had at the time.
Right.
Silent when they were, you know, in motion. They weren't making any sounds. They didn't leave a trail. And my favorite, circular or elliptical in shape, domed on top, flat on bottom. That's a flying saucer.
How much more clear can you get? Yeah.
How much more? Exactly. And or another of my favorites, a 1952 memo to the director of the CIA from his chief of scientific intelligence, which just stated, you know, at this time, these reports of objects at high altitudes and at great speeds over sensitive installations are of such nature that they're not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. I mean, again, how much more explicit do you want? Here's the director of scientific intelligence of the CIA telling his boss, the director of the CIA, that these are not attributable to anything we can figure out, but they're serious and they're over sensitive installations. So, you know, short of saying, boss, I think we're being invaded, he's obviously stating something very important. And again, the key here isn't to prove that these are alien. The key is to point out that while this serious conversation was taking place within the military and the intelligence community, the government was telling the people, nothing to see here, keep it moving, nothing to worry about, nothing to pay attention, it's all ridiculous nonsense. So it was a lie. That's a provable cover-up. And if nothing else, that should tweak our curiosity. Like, we should wonder, why is this the case?
Right.
And that's what I've been trying to figure out for the last 25 years. Why do they lie about UFOs?
Yeah, exactly. There's got to be something more to it. Well, we got a good question. We got a hop in chat here. Hello, everybody. You're doing great in that chat room. We got a question from Heidi. She's saying, what are Richard's thoughts on the subject post-truth being covered at the next Bilderberg meeting? Get together. Could it be disclosure of some sorts? I don't know if you heard about this. Apparently, there's some kind of theory going around that they're talking about a post-truth event or something like that.
Oh, that's very interesting. I should have been on top of this. The Bilderberg meetings are taking place. They happen every June.
Yeah.
And so this is the time. So it was a post-truth discussion, apparently, or that, like, the Bilderberg meetings, well, every year they have an agenda, basically,
right,
of what they will talk about. So if post-truth is on the agenda, and that's what I'm understanding from this person, I don't really know how to interpret that just at the moment. I mean, we live in what many people call the post-truth era, in the sense that it's very difficult now with all the noise coming into our culture from every direction. How do we actually ascertain what is true and what is not true in an era of fake news, where we hear this phrase fake news everywhere we go, when in fact the greatest purveyor of fake news remains the establishment corporate media, no matter what they tell you to the contrary. You know, how does one determine what is truth? And to that extent, we live in a post-truth era. In my view, we're never truly in a post-truth era, because truth always exists and it's always available, in my opinion, for us to grasp and to understand, although we have to struggle to get it sometimes. We have to fight for it. So I wish I could answer that question on, and what exactly does this mean? I wish I had known beforehand that the Bilderbergers were doing this and had some time to investigate. But unfortunately, I don't really know how to answer that any more than what I just said.
Yeah, that makes sense. She's actually continuing. She's saying, I've got the document. I've got the agenda. So she's going to send it over to me on my Facebook page, and I'll fire it over to you, Richard. Good. This is all kind of happening right now at Bilderberg, I believe. Is it must still be happening. I know Dan Dix is over there covering it from Canada, but it's always an interesting thing just about the Bilderberg Group. When we're talking about secrecy, How back in the day you had these Jim Tuckers and other guys that were Daniel Estelinson and all that investigating groups like Bilderberg and saying, it's real. Correct. And the whole time the media did the same thing. And everybody was like, nah, it's a conspiracy theory. All the Bilderbergers, Illuminati, whatever. And then now they have a website. They post their agenda. They're like, yep, all these big people that are violating the Logan Act are meeting regularly to discuss policy. And we, other than that, we just talk about golf. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, they've all been outed, so they just decide, well, we might as well make the best of it and just build our brand.
Yeah,
it's amazing. You know, when the media would deny this all this time, it's so utterly dishonest. I mean, they should all be just thrown out, all of these media people, because they all participated in the Bilderberg meetings. I mean, Bilderberg isn't just the masters of the universe, you know, the bankers, the banksters and those criminals, and they are criminals for the most part. But it also included media. Major media was always part of the Bilderberg meetings. Why? Because their cooperation has always been necessary to ensure silence, that it wasn't covered. So,
and Rockefeller himself actually thanked. He had that quote in his memoirs where he was thanking the New York Times, the Washington Post for keeping all of our agendas and meetings secret and the CFR and all of that. And without your help covering all this up, we wouldn't be here today. So that, I mean, there's so many places where this is openly admitted. And I feel like it's the same thing when it comes to this subject of the UFO cover-up. I think your average person around, if you talk to people in any country of the world, this is a subject that everybody knows about. You can't go anywhere on earth and say the word UFO without somebody who doesn't even speak English knowing what you're talking about. Everybody and their mother has an experience to share. It's hard to differentiate the misidentified or misunderstood or psychotic episodes that are now interpreted as an experience or whatever. It's hard to differentiate sometimes, but in your opinion, there are a lot of really, really good cases of people who have had experiences. I mean, you've interviewed these people for years. How do you tell the genuine article from most of the stuff out there that's just part of the circus, you know?
Well, when I hear an account from a person, I mean, what makes it strongest is if there's corroboration. So I'm always looking for corroboration in any form that I can. If it's a multiple witness sighting, for example, that's usually good. But a lot of times, you know, you'll have individual witnesses and they experience something on their own. And all you're really left with in some cases is the level of detail of the individual and your own personal assessment of how reliable they are. And none of that is perfect, unfortunately. It's true that this phenomenon often happens to people, not always, but it often happens to people when they are in an isolated state. You often find people, they're out alone, they're walking their dog, or they're having a cigarette outside, or they're in their hot tub and they look up and they, a lot of hot tub sightings, actually.
That's the best place to be, yeah.
Well, if you have one, you're going to be in it and you'll be looking up. And so there's a high percentage of people who, but anyway, so a lot of times people will be alone when they see something like this. And so I'm in a position of having to just judge them to the best of my ability. I had a couple of very, very unusual stories from people, a few I've talked about. There was a woman I interviewed about a decade ago. She was living in Western Pennsylvania, and she just told me a story about when she was in church in the 1960s as a teenager with her mother. In her town, everyone knew everyone, particularly in church. And she saw these two blonde, beautiful blonde male-female couple, perfect blue clothing, sit right in front of her. And she said she heard them telepathically. She was absolutely 100% convinced of it until she heard them having a conversation telepathically, like, oh, we appear to be fitting in. Mm-hmm. And then the one said, yes, but the girl behind us can hear us. And at that point, she ceased hearing them. And for the rest of the church mass service, she didn't hear anything come out of them. Then they left at the end of the service, and she followed them out to a field where they were walking across a field into the woods. There was this large being at the entrance of the woods who looked like Lurch from the Addams Family, she said. And this couple went past them into the woods, and she was too afraid to go any further. I had a very similar story. So she was a lone witness. But she told me the story with her husband. And all I can say is that I listened to her and I thought she's seemed very believable to me. 2 years later, actually, no, excuse me, 2 years earlier, I'd had a confidential conversation with a retired U.S. Air Force colonel who was also a PhD, with his wife. And the two of them had an experience together where he experienced telepathically the thoughts of a beautiful blonde couple, this time in Las Vegas. But the wife was there, and they had another friend with them. And I listened to this colonel and his wife tell me that story, which is really quite similar in many ways to what this woman across the country in Pennsylvania had said to me. So when I get stories like that where there's not necessarily corroboration, but there's a similar pattern from people who there was no motivation that I could see for them to tell me anything other than the truth. What I tend to believe is that these experiences happen to these people, and I've just had so many. The sheer quantity is what strikes me more than anything else. It's like, you know, if you have one or two of these encounters that people tell you about, you could chalk it off to, you know,
yeah, you're just crazy. You drank too much the night before, yeah, right. Or whatever.
But exactly. But the thing is, there's just so many of these stories, and they come from every sociological background that I can identify, like every race, every culture, every belief system.
Yes, that's a big one.
People who are hardcore UFO believers, or people who are hardcore skeptics, and they have these stories for me. So, you know, when the stories cut across all boundaries that I can visualize, then I have to think something is happening, and it's difficult to quantify. So, a physical scientist might not be satisfied, right, with the quality of the evidence. Well, to which I just say, I'm sorry, this is what the evidence is. And you can either accept it or ignore it. You can try to work with it, puzzle it out, or you can pretend it doesn't exist. And I guess I choose that I would like to look at it and puzzle it out, even if I can't prove.
Right.
To my ultimate satisfaction, I know that there's something going on. Very, very important. Very important.
Where there's smoke,
and
there's
the last
fire.
Thing, right? I just want to say that, because I see we're getting toward the top of the hour here. This isn't just a secret that's being kept from us, that's essentially holding our future hostage, which it really is, but it's also a really expensive secret. This is a lot of money. One thing that I think is very clear is that maintaining this secret, it's not free. So there's the bribery, there's the classified scientific research and development, there's the construction of massive underground facilities to study all of this. I mean, that's expensive, and that all gets siphoned out of our society and goes who knows where. But then there's all of the development of classified technology that I am convinced at this point has been withheld from us and is preventing us from moving forward to where we really ought to be in our civilization. So these are secrets that aren't free. They come at a price, both financially to citizens, and also in terms of the price held to our future, and also a psychic price. When you have a government that institutes such a deep and profound lie that, you know, it's as if you're being gaslit by your government. So in other words, there's this reality going on, and they continually say to you, no, it's not happening. And so what does that do? It causes people, I think, to lose confidence in their perceptions.
Right.
And or it causes them to lose confidence in their government, both of which are bad. Like, we really, for a healthy, functioning society, we want to have confidence in our perceptions, and we want to have confidence in our elected representatives who are supposed to be representing us and our interests in our government. I mean, that's what it's about.
Yes.
And by having instituting a lie on such a level for such a long period of time, it does, I'm convinced, it does bad things to us individually, and it does very bad things to us as a society.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Well said. Well, we've got about 5 minutes here, Richard. I'm just going to follow up on the Bilderberg situation here, because I just want to thank Heidi, one of our viewers. We always have good viewers here, who sent me this actual agenda. And then I have one final question for you, Richard. So let's do the agenda. So this is the 66th Bilderberg meeting. It just wrapped up on the 10th of June. And here are the 12 points of discussion by the most elite people that you can imagine. Number one, populism in Europe. Number two, the inequality challenge. It's all a bunch of Marxist nonsense, eh? Number three, the future of work. Four, artificial intelligence.
I don't know about that. Yeah, go on.
Five, the U.S. before midterms. Six, free trade. Seven, U.S. world leadership. Eight, Russia. Nine, quantum computing. 10, Saudi Arabia and Iran. 11, the post-truth world. 12, current events.
That's fascinating. I'm going to grab my copy of that.
I'll send it to you.
What you find with, yeah, please, the Bilderberger meetings, the Bilderberg meetings, I guess is how we pronounce it, but they are always very prescient. That is, they're very forward-looking. And like back in 1983, 2 years before Gorbachev, one of the Bilderberg agenda items was on the future of the Soviet Union. And then 2 years later comes Gorbachev and the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. Like that to me is not a coincidence at all. So what the Bilderberg people have as their agenda items happen in reality. And the reason is really simple. I mentioned that there are 200 or so sovereign nations, but of course they're not all equal, right? And if you're one of those people at the very top of the hierarchy, your attitude is going to be, oh my goodness, we can't work with all of these countries to create the world that we know is best for the rest of humanity. And they feel that they do know what's best. So what do? They do the logical thing, which is they gather together informally in their own locus of power, which are these types of meetings. It's not just Bilderberg. It's, you know, the meetings of the Council on Foreign Relations or the meetings at Bohemian Grove or, you know, lots of meetings in golf courses and five-star hotels. But the Bilderberg is one of these meetings where they formally do get together and hash this stuff out. And then they go back to their own centers of power and they do their best to, usually very effectively, to make these things happen. So in terms of populism in Europe, that was the first item. That's a really big issue for them. And they absolutely don't like that. They love the EU. They love the European Union because it's the ultimate technocrat dream. It's the most anti-democratic institution that I can even imagine for Europe to have. It's something that they have been planning for a long time that the Bilderberg people made happen. You know, they're the ones who really pushed the common market and then the European Union over the years. It's all about creating a global system.
Yeah.
And one thing to keep in mind about these Bilderbergs is it's in their, they actually have a, what do I want to call it? Not a treatise, but they're like their constitution, for lack of a better word. In that document, it's very explicit that their goals are to increase the profitability of the enterprises of the members themselves. So they're really out to make money for themselves. And they do this by creating a global system that's amenable to their interests. And so globalization in and of itself doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, in fact, globalization can be a very good thing in many ways.
Right.
To have an integrated world economy so that we can make a telephone call from New York to Vancouver or from South America to China or whatever. You need a global infrastructure and globalization is important, or to do financial trading internationally, all of that. You need a global system. And I don't think anyone's saying that we shouldn't have that. But globalization can look like freedom or it can look like fascism.
Right.
Globalization can be something that's responsive to some extent to the public, or it can be something that's responsive only to a small number of private individuals who have really all the goodies, own everything. And so that's the way globalization's turning out. You know, but again, globalization in and of itself doesn't have to be bad. There are reasons to think it could be a good thing. It's happening that the way it's progressing is completely elitist, completely designed for the benefit of a very, very few people for whom all the rest of us are going to work for the rest of all time if they have their way. That's you and me and our children and our children's children and so on forever. We'll always be working for those people. It's really a new royalty is what's being instituted on this planet. And that's what they're wanting. That's what they're aiming for. So crush populism, absolutely. You know, call it racism, call it any other kind of smear that you can. Absolutely. And that's what they do. So to do that, they need to have control over the media. I mean, my God, we could really go on and on about this. This is a very, very important thing. It's all about changing world culture and transforming world culture in ways that create a docile population. So you do that by removing economic opportunity, which they're absolutely doing by bureaucratizing, technocratizing, if that's a word, and removing opportunity, you know, offshoring jobs, increasingly so that people have really nothing to do. There's a, you know, a middle class who is just in the hamster wheel spinning around and around and around if you're lucky enough to have a job. So you remove economic opportunity, you remove privacy so that people have no sense of their own privacy anymore through computers monitoring everything that you do, every website, every email, every text message, or every street corner. People are now growing up, young people, with no expectation of privacy in their world. Mm. And what's insane to me is that so many of them don't seem to care. Right. They just take it as a given. So by creating a new culture, and then there's the entire attack on traditional masculinity and traditional femininity.
Right.
And people shouldn't think that that's separate. That's an integral part of this as well. It's to detach us from our core being. Mm. It really is. And so by promoting, it's to destabilize our personality, in my view, and to and it's not that people can't change their sexuality or they can't, a man can't be effeminate or a woman can't be masculine, but to promote actively certain types of transformations of classical traditional personalities, I think is a very dangerous thing. And it's clearly an agenda item. So it's to unmoor us from our classical psychology, making us, in my view, much more docile, much more amenable to control in this transformation of the global system for the benefit of a very few people. And then, of course, the other rest of it is to have people get lost in virtual reality, fantasy, hypersexuality, all of these things to distract us from the things that actually matter in this world. And you know, they're succeeding. Let's make no mistake. If we don't wake up, they will succeed. All right. So what we think is liberation through drugs or liberation through sexuality or liberation through fantasy, that's not liberation. That's control.
Wow. Wow. Very well said. I agree with every word. Very good, Richard. Richard, I know you got to go, but I have one burning question for you. There's a new movie coming out with Ryan Gosling. It looks pretty good, actually. It's called The First Man, and it's talking about the first landing on the moon. Do you want to give a quick, I remember we had a discussion about this a while back. I want to know your current thoughts on, did we go to the moon? Was it a fake mission or was it just classified? Do you have any final parting words on that subject?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating question, you know, about the moon landings. And I'm just going to say this right out. The most irritating, annoying, rude, obnoxious people in this field that I've ever met are those who are convinced we did not go to the moon. It's one thing to have a disagreement, but it's another thing to be so pugnacious as so many of these folks are. I don't really understand why. They have a real major personality issues that a lot of them have to work out, in my opinion. What I believe is that we did go to the moon, but that two things. A, there were fake moon landings that were in the tank and ready to go. And I just had a conversation with a former astronaut, Ken Johnston, who worked for NASA for many, many years. And he wasn't part of the Apollo missions, but he was a trained astronaut and was in that whole culture. And he said, yeah, look, we filmed fake moon landings in case the whole thing failed. I was shocked when he told me this. This is just a week ago when I was talking with him. And I think that that's actually, it's believable to me because there are really odd anomalies, without a doubt, about the moon landings, in my view as well. I think a lot of the skeptics of the moon landing have made a good case, but my current thinking on this is that this is not the actual NASA video that they're looking at. I think they're looking at least some of this, maybe a Hollywood creation, Stanley Kubrick and the rest. The other thing that I believe is that the astronauts did go to the moon, but that they were monitored on the moon. And I believe this, I'm going to say pretty confidently, there's a number of, a lot of testimony that's come out over the years that indicates this going way back to the 1970s. A woman named Donna Hare. There's a gentleman named Carl Wolf. And right on through. In fact, Ken Johnston himself was talking to me about how during the Apollo 11 mission, Neil Armstrong switched to an alternate channel to describe how they were being watched at that time and so forth. So I think, and I had a conversation with the researcher, Timothy Good, about a contact that he had who eavesdropped on a conversation that Neil Armstrong had at some function where he was saying essentially the same thing, that they were monitored the whole time that they were on the moon. So I think there's enough of that out there to make me think that they did go. I don't see it as an impossibility that we had the technology to do it. But there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm not pretending, even now that I personally have all the answers here, and I could turn out to be wrong. I've been wrong about other things in this world, and if I'm wrong about this, well, I'll just have to correct my opinion at some point.
Well, we also got to get rid of all the secrecy so we can all start to get to know what the truth is. But guys, RichardDolanPress.com is Richard's website. You have to go check him out, check out his books, and come and see us at this event. Architects of the New Paradigm, happening Vancouver, June 30th. I'm going to be there. Come and see us. Thank you so much for tuning in, Richard. It was a pleasure. Let's do it again sometime, my friend.
Oh, I'm glad we got the glitch in the beginning worked out. I'm so sorry about all those extra tabs. I will just mention, I have another website that is a recent creation called Richard Dolan Members. Lots of blog, video, audio content up there for anyone who's interested in checking that out as well. It's keeping me and Tracy quite busy these days.
Oh, absolutely. Well, congratulations on that. And thanks to you, Richard, and thanks to all of our awesome viewers who are in there chatting. Sorry we didn't get to everybody's questions. We had a short time with Richard, but we'll catch up with you guys again soon. We've got more content coming your way here on Way of the Truth Warrior. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers.